Hello, Doug Brown joining Brendan Stone today on Unusual Sources on CFMU Radio 93.3 FM, broadcasting out of McMaster University. Well, we have a special guest today, and we're going to devote most of the show. Our guest is Ken Stone, who has just recently returned from Syria. Ken was part of an international group that was observing the local elections there, and Ken filed many reports. He was a very busy man while he was in Syria, and we've got Ken in the studio, and we are going to, as I said, we're going to spend most of the program. We're going to take a break about halfway through because we have a lot of ground to cover, and Ken saw a lot, and there's a lot to report on. So, Ken, welcome.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, Ken, first of all, tell us about how this trip came about, like who organized it and who was on it and, you know, the logistics of getting over there.
Well, the trip was organized by a group called the Social Justice Network in Australia. And this was the second tour of peace to Syria. They had one last fall, and what happened was that they put out announcements and they sent out invitations. I got an invitation to participate, and so I jumped on the opportunity to go, and I did some crowdfunding through GoFundMe, and actually, the community in Hamilton, the anti-war community and peace community, was really generous and covered almost all of my expenses to go there, so I was really pleased. And I thought it would be incumbent upon me to write something, write stories and write reports from there, so as to, I felt it would justify the confidence that people put in me by giving me 20s and 50s and $100 bills to go to this tour. Now, you don't have to wait till the next one, Doug, to be invited. You can go to the Facebook page of the, it's called International Tours of Peace to Syria, and they're having the next one in September. So that's a good time of year to go to Syria because it's not in the summer months, it's not burning hot, should be pretty nice weather, and I'll bet you there's a lot more to report by September.
Yes, well, there's certainly a lot going on, and so this was the second of what looks like it'll be a series of international visits to Syria.
That's right. And what happens is you're responsible for getting yourself to Beirut, the airfare, and then the cost of the actual tour was $550 U.S., for a double room and $650 for a single room. So that was basically the cost of the trip. And the airfare for me was $1,100 Canadian. So it wasn't too bad. There were a lot of incidental expenses, and you have to stay a night in Beirut. But they you arrive in Beirut, they pick you up in a bus, they take you to Syria, they put you in a five-star hotel. They take you all over Syria. They bring you back to Beirut. So it's and you're in good hands. You're in government-controlled areas, you are with security. You're with travel guides. You're with cultural travel guides. So it's the best of everything. The Syrian people are exceptionally hospitable and friendly. Everywhere we went, people of every walk of life went out of their way to make us feel welcome.
And this being an international group, you had representatives from another number of countries.
Yes, there were Norwegians, Americans. There was me from Canada. There was a Lebanese and a Jordanian.
Okay, so a nice mixture of people. And also, you had a few people that spoke Arabic right in your group.
Yes, we did. And so we were able to talk directly to the people on the street, and we didn't rely on an official interpreter. And in fact, the official guide who was a representative of both a tour company, a private tour company that organized the tour in Syria, and also a coordinator with the Syrian Ministry of Tourism. He was fluently bilingual in Arabic and English, and we weren't limited to who we spoke to. We could speak to anybody. And on the day of the election, for example, I just walked into five polling stations and randomly picked people, and I had people translate for me, and I got the most wonderful reactions.
Well, that's really good, and you filed some wonderful reports throughout your visit. I think there was, six in total reports you filed?
Yeah, six.
And our listeners, if they're interested, reports, I understand they're on Crescent...
Crescent-online.net. Crescent-online.net. And the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War is taking steps now to reproduce those reports in a pamphlet. So in a few weeks, hopefully, we'll have a pamphlet.
Yeah, I've read most of them, and you have a very nice writing style. It's not academic reading at all. It's very personable, and makes it really an easy read, but a very informative read to hear your experiences firsthand. But let's hear about some of your experiences firsthand right now. So you, as you said, you flew into Beirut, and you got taken together, I guess, into right to Damascus.
That's right.
Yeah, and then you were there specifically for the local elections. Can you tell us a little bit about the elections?
Yes, it was a national election, actually, the parliamentary elections. Under the Constitution of 2012, they're supposed to have parliamentary elections every 4 years, and so they haven't had them since 2012, and so they were due. But the international community, I'm using the euphemism for the Western countries of the world, basically the NATO countries, didn't want the Syrian government to hold elections because, according to the Geneva One agreement in June the 1st, 2012, there was supposed to be a transitional government, and then once a transitional government was formed, there were supposed to be elections within 18 months. However, there hasn't yet been a successful negotiation at Geneva for peace. The latest ones just broke down a few days ago. The only ones who showed up to talk was actually the Syrian government. The opposition, organized by the United States and by Saudi Arabia, didn't bother coming to talks. I mean, they were in Geneva, but they didn't come to the table to talk. They didn't come into the same building to talk. So what the Syrian government decided was that since the Geneva One agreement did not specifically ban or prevent the Syrian government from holding elections on its own, it decided to go ahead and hold these elections. And it was a defiant move by the Syrian government. It described the elections that just took place as an exercise in sovereignty. What they were saying was that to the Western countries and the Gulf monarchs was, you may think that you are going to decide the future of Syria at the peace talks in Geneva, and while we agree that to come and participate in these peace talks, in the end, the Syrian people are going to decide their future. And so they held these elections to show the world that the Syrian people are insistent on exercising their right to self-determination by choosing their own leaders. This was the purpose of the elections, and that defiant attitude was reflected on the streets. It was reflected everywhere we went in Syria in the days of the election and following the election. For example, we started out on the first morning of the election by going to visit the Greek Melkite Patriarch. He's something like the Pope for Greek Melkite Catholics all over the world, millions of them. And we had a nice chat with him, and he explained that this election was to show the world that Syrians were going to decide their own future. And he not only made that statement, but he wanted to show his support for the Syrian government and for the election process by leaving the audience he had granted with us, leading a procession from his church through the narrow streets of the old city of Damascus to the Armenian church, where he was met by the spiritual head of the Armenian church. And in all their flowing robes and with all their followers, they marched next door to the school, the Armenian school, where there was a big polling station, and they all went in there, and they went behind the screen to cast their ballots, and the Greek patriarch was the very first person to come and put his ballot in the ballot box. So he was making a statement here that of his support for the Syrian government, number one, because it's a secular state, and the Syrian government is the only possible guarantee of religious freedom in Syria. I think Canadians would understand, we cherish and we value our multiculturalism in Canada, our pluralism, the fact that everybody has the right to freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and so forth. And we value all the contributions of various communities and religions to Canada, to the cultural mosaic. And in Syria, they have a very similar kind of pluralism. And the Syrian government has always maintained that all the religions and sects that live in Syria, and there's many of them, there's Catholics, there's Muslims, there were Jews, and there are Muslims of various sects. There's Alawites, there's Druze, and there's a whole panoply of people. Plus, there are ethnic minorities in the country, and the underlying agreement of this in the Syrian government and state is that it's a secular country where all these people are allowed to practice their cultural traditions and their religious traditions. So that's why, in the face of these ISIS and al-Nusra terrorists who come in and kill anybody, behead people who don't belong to their particular sect, so in the face of that kind of existential threat, all the religious minorities, not only the Greek patriarch, but the Druze leaders and all the other religious leaders all supported the election. They all came out and encouraged their flocks to come out and vote. And the Greek patriarch was, you know, very exemplary. He marched through the old streets and led people to the ballot box, told them to vote, and said that this was an example to the rest of the world, and especially to the Arab world, where the Western countries are creating divisions between Sunni and Shia, between Druze and Arab, and between Kurds and Arabs. They want to continue with a pluralistic, multicultural Syria, and that's what the election was about.
Now, the election itself, was there a diversity of candidates, you know, like in terms of whether they're Sunni or Shia or Christian? Did you look at that aspect of it?
Well, there was there were a horde of candidates, actually. There were 250 seats that were open for grabs. That's in the parliament. Now, in Syria, Syria is not a liberal democracy. It's not Canada. And 65% of the seats in the government are allocated to the Ba'ath Party and to its allies in the, I think it's called the Syrian National Coalition, and a bunch of other parties that are allied to the Ba'ath Party. So 65% of the seats are guaranteed for that group of people. Then there are the other 35% of the seats are open to anyone. So for the 250 seats that were open, there were initially 10,000 candidates. That's 40 candidates for every single, on the average, for every single seat. And by a lot of these candidates became discouraged over the month that took of electioneering that took place. Most of them resigned. So by election day, there were 3,000 candidates for 250 seats. And if you well, when we were going through the old city and driving down the highway and so on, all the walls were plastered with the pictures of election posters, and banners were hanging across all the streets. You couldn't go anywhere without knowing an election was going on. There were pictures of individual candidates, there were pictures of small groups of candidates, and then there were pictures, long banners with pictures of lots of candidates representing a certain slate. So I would say that there was a wealth of candidates of every kind of background you can possibly imagine, and the Syrian people had a big choice, a big spectrum of people from whom to choose.
They must have had large ballots with so many candidates.
Well, it's different. You have, if you've ever been in a union, you'd understand how it works, you see. It's not, because the election favors the one party and its allies, what happens is that on election morning, when we went out in the street with our guide, on every corner there were small groups of three or four young people, and they're handing out quarter-page flyers with the list of the slate that they supported. So when you got to the polling station, if you wanted in Damascus, there were 29 candidates to vote for. So if you wanted, you could go behind the screen, take your ballot, and fill in 29 names, which is kind of a laborious process, one would think, right? Or you could take one of these election slates, say you wanted to vote all opposition candidates. And there is a democratic opposition inside Syria. There are many parties inside Syria that work within the gubernatorial system, the state system, to provide criticism and opposition to the government, and don't pick up arms, and don't take money from the West, and don't behead people, and don't destroy buildings and so on. That opposition exists, and so you could take the ballot, the slate list, and you could put it, take your ballot and put it in the envelope, and just hand it, and then just put it into the ballot box. So that way it saves, if you know what slate you're voting for, you just take the slate list, put it in the box, done. You also have the opportunity to take the slate list and scratch out certain names, the people you don't like on the slate, and you can even add names to the slate of people you do like. So you could see why it would take almost, sometimes up to a week to count all the ballots. It's very much like a union convention, where you walk in and there's the governing slate and there's an opposition slate, and the delegates at the convention get to vote for one or the other. And that's how I think you should look at it. The government was looking for a mandate. They were looking for a mandate because they were going 2 days later to Geneva at the peace talks, and they wanted to be able to say, we have a mandate from the people of Syria to continue governing and to speak on their behalf. And what they got was less than they were hoping for. They got a 58% turnout, a 58% mandate, which is not something you'd want to go into a strike vote with here in Canada, into a strike with. But it was a mandate. And if you want to compare it to the armed opposition that the United States and Saudi Arabia put together to go to the Geneva peace talks, those people, those head choppers, those foreign-backed militants have never held an election in any of the parts of Syria that they invaded and occupied. And in fact, the people in those areas voted in a different way. They voted with their feet. As soon as those terrorist mercenaries came in, they ran away. They either went to Turkey, Lebanon, or Jordan, or they went to some government-held area. So the government came into the negotiations with a mandate, whereas the opposition has no mandate whatsoever, the armed opposition.
Right. Okay. And this is CFMU Unusual Sources, and we are talking to Ken Stone, who has just returned from Syria with an international delegation that was observing the elections that were recently held there. So, Ken, they were disappointed, I guess, with the 58%, but on the other hand, I think Canadians would be thrilled with getting that kind of voter turnout.
Well, you're absolutely right, Doug. In this last federal election we had, October 19th, 2015, there was a 58% turnout, and that was about 8 or 10% better than the last two or three elections. Now, if you want to, the U.S. State Department dismissed the Syrian election out of hand before it even happened, before the results were in. But if you want to look at it from the point of view of participation rate, voter turnout, in the last U.S. federal election, there was a 48% turnout, 10% less than the Syrian turnout.
Right. So, and you know, and also recognizing this, this is many areas are still war zones. It must make it very difficult to even have balloting in areas that are being contested.
Good point, Doug. And that was something that was brought up to us in some areas they had where the government was completely in control. They got over 80% turnout. And in other places like Aleppo, around 50%, which are partially occupied by the foreign-backed mercenaries. So that we could say that it was a bit of a gamble for them to hold an election in wartime with a third of the country occupied. And the other part of it is there's no way to have an enumeration. To go around and knock on people's doors. They just had people show up with their identification card. They marked down their names. They let them vote, and then they put their fingers in an indelible ink, one finger in an indelible ink afterwards so they couldn't vote a second time. But the Syrian government officials told us that, frankly, they don't know how many people are outside the country right now, Syrians are outside the country, and how many have been killed in the last 5 years of fighting.
Right. Okay. Now, in one of your dispatches, you had described how the Syrian government is trying to approach reconciliation, which is an important aspect in order to achieve peace and unity back in Syria. Can you elaborate on what you were told by Syrian government representatives about how they are approaching reconciliation?
Yeah, we were lucky enough to get a meeting with the Minister of Reconciliation, and he is the leader of an opposition party in Syria, but he's part of the government. So this is part of the reconciliation process itself, in that in the last few years, the Ba'ath Party and the Syrian government has reformed itself so that the domestic opposition, the opposition that has not resorted to arms and killing and head chopping, are taking part in the government itself. And we had a long meeting with him at his office, and he told us that the Syrian government had up to now 50 successful reconciliation projects. And what is a reconciliation project? Well, it's when they have a standoff, and they have many standoffs in these situations where the mercenaries have come in armed to the teeth with all the latest equipment, and they dig themselves into a part of a city. They make loopholes between the buildings and tunnels and stuff. It's really, really difficult for the Syrian army to eradicate them using heavy artillery bombing and aerial bombing and so on, and getting a lot of people killed. So what these mercenaries are not very popular with the local people. So what the Syrian government has done is they form a committee of influential people in the town, and they ask these people to act independently as much as possible and go among the mercenaries and offer them a deal. And the deal is you can leave, we'll get you a safe conduct out of the country. Or you can lay down your arms, and if there are Syrians among you, the Syrian people will be given amnesties. And a third possibility, and this has happened on many occasions, the Syrians who have been in the opposition have rethought, after experiencing being working with these foreign-backed mercenaries and their bloody methods, they actually turn around and join the Syrian army, and they're even allowed to form their own battalions. So what's happened is, in many cases, like as in Homs, which we visited, and was the whole old city was a ruin. The reconciliation project got the last 1,000 of those terrorist mercenaries to walk out of town, and the Syrian government let them go, and they got safe passage out of the country. So there was no more the necessity of fighting and killing. A lot of lives were saved by these reconciliation projects, and many truces were arranged in this manner so that civilians could get out of the way, get out of these combat zones. So reconciliation with the Syrians, not the foreign. These mercenaries are recruited from 80 different countries. So they have no interest in reconciliation with the Syrian government. They're not there for reconciliation. They're there because they're being paid to be there. They get to loot, rape, kill, and basically enrich themselves from this operation. But the Syrians who ended up in these armed groups, they often see the error of their ways, and this reconciliation project allows for them to be, rehabilitated and brought back into Syrian life. So it's something unique and different that I've never experienced before.
Yeah, it seems like a very good approach, and also the idea of recognizing that there's two groups. There's all these foreign mercenaries, and then there's Syrians who have taken up arms. And you wonder how can anyone really justify the rights of foreign mercenaries? They're not from that country, and they've chosen to attack it. Surely they cannot have any reasonable complaint against the Syrian government not having lived there.
Well, that's true. But these foreign-funded mercenaries, foreign-backed mercenaries, are just the puppets. The strings are being pulled from the capitals of Washington, London, Paris, Rome, and unfortunately, under the Harper government from Ottawa as well. So what the major crime here is that in the West, NATO countries, especially the United States, feel that they don't recognize, they don't respect the sovereignty of other countries. They didn't respect the sovereignty of Syria. They decided to go for regime change. Nobody gave them the right to decide who was going to be the leader or which was going to be the government of Syria. But they took it upon themselves to try and overthrow that government. And that was the original and root cause of this terrible humanitarian tragedy that's affected Syria and actually with the refugees all of Europe.
Yes, and if memory serves correct, I think it was General Wesley Clark had a list of countries that the U.S. was going to do regime change on. About half of them, it's already happened.
More than half.
More than half. Yeah. So Iraq and Libya.
I think the only one that hasn't been attacked is Iran.
Yeah. Yeah, although there's certainly been intervention in Iran, and tremendous pressure with sanctions and so forth. Okay, well, one of, I think, probably a highlight of your trip, looking at your reports, was your group actually got taken to Palmyra.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. It happened that about a week before we got there, Palmyra was liberated. It was liberated by the Syrian army on the ground with strong support from the Russian Air Force. And they were able to drive ISIS out of Palmyra and the adjoining new town, which is called Todmor. And, of course, there was a lot of damage to the new town of Todmor. But worse, even I would say at least as bad, was the fact that while they were in control of Palmyra, the ISIS mercenaries destroyed some priceless relics of the world's, humanity's common heritage. In Palmyra, they destroyed the Temple of Bel, they destroyed another temple, and they destroyed the Arch of Triumph. Palmyra was an important caravan stop on the Syrian Silk Route. It was an oasis in the desert, and it was built into a magnificent Roman city in the Common Era. You can still see the colonnade, which was the main street, which had two rows of columns and a roof on top with trees down the sides. And we went into the amphitheater, which holds 2,500 people. So that's truly magnificent as well. But what these barbarians from ISIS, having no respect for anything but their own particular sectarian views, which are Wahhabi views, which come from Saudi Arabia, who is the main funder of ISIS and a lot of these other terrorist organizations, they decided that since these buildings inside Palmyra were not representative of their particular brand of Islam, they deserved to be brought down, and they brought them down. when we arrived, we came into, you have to go into the town of Todmor in order to get to the ancient site of Palmyra, which, by the way, was so beautiful it was called the Bride of the Desert in ancient times. And when we went into Todmor, we witnessed the devastation of buildings that were all, many of them pancaked. These are reinforced concrete buildings, apartment buildings that, one floor pancaked on another and buildings leaning against each other, rubble in the streets. But we were on that. There, we arrived on the day that the Russians and the Syrians had allowed the inhabitants to come back to evaluate the damage to their particular homes and apartments and to collect their belongings from among the rubble. What had happened in the previous week was that the Russian sappers had been working away busily. They had removed and blown up some 3,000 mines that the ISIS mercenaries had left on the ancient Roman site and in the town. Plus, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands more booby traps that they intended the civilians of Todmor to be killed by when they went back to their homes. So on the day we arrived, the Russians had given the green light for the people to come back. And the streets were full of buses and trucks that the inhabitants had come back to load their stuff into. And when we came into town, the members on our little bus, the little tour bus, we members of the delegation, the Solidarity delegation, were just overwhelmed with pity for the people who were picking through the rubble and bringing the stuff from their houses onto the sidewalks, sorting through it and loading it up into the buses and on top of the trucks and in the trucks. As with many other things about Syria, all of us were surprised by what the Syrian people thought and their spirit. And we went up to just one family group on the street, and one of our people asked in Arabic, said, "Well, how are you folks coping?" And, the patriarch of the family, he looked up at us and he smiled. And contrary to all the things that we thought the people there were suffering, he said, everything is great, and it's going to get better, because now that those ISIS terrorists are gone, everything is going to be good. They were so relieved that was the main thing in their lives, to get those terrorists out of there. And he said, and as for the city itself, we'll rebuild it, and it'll be twice as good as before. So our preconceived notions of how the Syrians might be feeling after five long years of war were wrong. People were relieved and happy that they got back the town from the mercenaries. And the main thing was they were all alive, and the future was going to be better.
Yeah, so did you get the impression the war has really turned, against these mercenaries?
Well, it's everywhere that we went. Of course, we were all only in government-held areas, mm-hmm. but in the everywhere we went, people. We thought people were, or at least I thought, that people were going to be depressed, down in the dumps, and pessimistic about the future, but actually. The people of Syria were full of defiance, and they showed that very clearly in the election process. And they when we were in Damascus, people were out on the streets all day because they had to, you know, to work. But now they were out at night too because the bombing had ceased. The shelling from Ghouta, the shelling had finally ceased 3 months ago. And people were back on the streets. We went out. We were invited out to nightclubs and restaurants, and the places were packed. People were eating and they were drinking, and they would break. You know, they would be playing live music, and some people would get up and start dancing, and then everybody would get up and start dancing, and then they would drag us into the dancing, and so and they would start singing patriotic songs about Syria. So you know. I don't think this was staged for us. I think this is what really is happening, and the people are actually optimistic, and I think that they feel that they've turned the corner, and they are going to get their country back.
Right. Now, again, in one of your dispatches, you talked about, I think somebody had worked as an archivist in Palmyra, and he had some, and of course was... extremely saddened by, you know, what he saw there. Can you relate that to us?
Oh yeah, that was our. He wasn't an archivist, but he was a tour guide, and he had personally. This is Antoine. He had personally led 300 tours to Palmyra during his career. He's now more or less semi-retired, but he came out to guide us for our trip. And when he came to the site, he got off the bus. And he started walking around in circles just saying, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And he did this for 5 or 10 minutes. And finally, you know, he turns to us and he said, you know, I thought I was going to cry. I had my handkerchief ready. But he said, you know, there are no tears left in Syria to weep for this. Mm. And he was looking at the museum at the entrance to the old site, the Roman site.
Right.
And the museum, of course, was locked, and the Syrian government had the foresight to take away all the precious relics inside and hide them somewhere, put them somewhere safe. But the big pieces outside, big statues, beautifully carved columns and with ornate capitals, that they left those outside because they were too big to move. And so in their frustration, the ISIS mercenaries had systematically destroyed everything that was in front of the museum, and it's all lying in pieces on the ground, like rubble. And that's what Antoine was looking at, and that's what caused him to say what he did, that there were just not enough tears left in Syria to weep for this.
Oh, it's really sad. I think we're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with more from Ken Stone on his recent visit to Syria. Well, we're back. We'll continue on with our interview with Ken Stone on his visit to Syria shortly. But before we do that... just a reminder, you're listening to Unusual Sources on CFMU 93.3 FM. And we've got a couple of announcements. So on Tuesday, May 10th, there's going to be a dinner and then a talk with Peter Larson. He's one of the few Canadians who's been into Gaza since the Israeli attack of 2014. And the theme of his talk is the future of the children of Gaza. So it's a four-course, you can get a four-course dinner at Homegrown for $25, but reservations are required. And then the Peter Larson's talk will begin at 7:30 p.m. So that's at Homegrown. That's on King William. It's just not too far from Jackson Square in the downtown in the downtown. And you can get further information on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website. Another event coming up a bit later, Monday, May 16th, the Negev Dinner is being held. That's a dinner for the Jewish National Fund. Now, Palestinian right activists have been picketing this this dinner to protest against the Jewish National Fund, which raises funds in Canada to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their homes and farms in Israel and Palestine. And we encourage people to come out and join the picket. That'll be May 16th, 5:30 p.m. The location has changed. Last year, I think it was at the Convention Center. This year, it's at La Yuna Station, 360 James Street North. So that's May 16th, 5:30, La Yuna Station, 360 James Street North. And this event is sponsored by Independent Jewish Voices and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. And you can get more information on their website. So getting back to our talk with Ken, we were just talking about Palmyra when we took the break. And, you talked about the sappers, these Russian military people that are experts at detecting landmines and explosives and getting rid of them. So can you tell us a little bit about what you saw in their work?
Yeah, they have robotic machines with continual tank treads that go out and find the mines, and we didn't actually get to see how they actually dispose of the mines, but the Russian sappers were busy working there that day, and there was actually a high-level Russian military delegation there, and they were very standoffish. We were not allowed to take photos. They didn't really want to talk to anybody. There were they had special forces all around guarding them, with lots of, with earpieces on and lots of heavy equipment and their fingers on the triggers of the AK-74s. They were a pretty impressive bunch of guys. What we did see was that the sappers had taken over a building in Todmore, and they had put up a big red banner, homemade banner over the front, and it said in Russian letters, in Cyrillic letters, "Sappers." They turned it into a clubhouse for themselves. And they had given orders for everybody to be out of town. I think it was 5 or 5:30 that day. And so after Antoine had given us about a 90-minute walkthrough of the ruins, where we got to see all the colonnade and the Roman amphitheater and what was left of the temples and Arch of Triumph, we got back on our bus and we were heading out. We were walking back toward the bus, and all of a sudden there were about 20 loud explosions in a row. Really, bang, bang, boom, 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 really loud, and the sky filled up with these plumes of smoke. Apparently, the sappers had behind the town of Todmore. They had found some new mines they had missed before, or some booby traps, and they were exploding them as we were leaving the town. And we also heard a little bit of small arms fire on the way out, because apparently some of the ISIS fighters were still up in the hills behind the town. So it gives you an idea of just how close it was, how recent it was that this town was liberated. And by the way, I want to point out that the Syrian army lost 200 soldiers retaking the town from ISIS. And in the first case, 10 months ago, when ISIS took the town, they also lost another 200. They lost another 200 soldiers. And in the time in between, while the ISIS was in control of the town, ISIS executed the curator of the museum, who's an 82-year-old man, They executed him in the public square and stuck his head on a pole for 3 days. And they took out a lot of vengeance on a lot of other people. But the most interesting part for your listeners, I think, would be the fact that to get to Palmyra in the first place, 10 months ago, the ISIS fighters traveled in several different convoys, one from the Iraqi border, which is hundreds of kilometers away, one from the town of Raqqa, which is their capital, also hundreds, a couple hundred kilometers away, and another one from Homs. So they traveled in these convoys, open convoys, across the open desert, and the U.S.-led coalition did not fire a single shot at them and did not drop a single bomb on them. So that indicates to me that the U.S.-led coalition wanted this to happen. They wanted ISIS to take Palmyra, which is at the confluence of 8 major roads, in order to affect John Kerry's Plan B, which is to partition Syria. And it's to the great credit of the Russians that their intervention last September 30th, a big military and diplomatic offensive, and in about 5 months, 4 or 5 months, they did more damage to ISIS and al-Nusra and some of these other foreign-backed groups than the U.S.-led coalition has done in a year and a half or 2 years. So it seems to prove the case to me what we've been saying in the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War is that these terrorist groups are assets of the U.S. They're part of U.S. foreign policy. They're part of the game of trying to affect regime change in Syria. They're part of the game of trying to divide Syria into redraw the boundaries and create a series of Balkanized states within Syria, just the way that they've done in Iraq.
Yeah, and not just the lack of any effective action against ISIS and al-Qaeda or al-Nusra. The other curious phenomenon was I heard a figure of 30,000 oil tanker trucks moving large volumes of oil, stolen oil from Syria to Turkey, and actually helping fund the whole ISIS operation this way without any interference from anybody.
Well, you heard correctly, Doug. There were regular convoys going out of Syria and going into Turkey every day, full of oil, tanker trucks, convoys miles long. And going the other way, there were up to 300 transport trucks carrying arms, equipment, and supplies into Syria from Turkey with the full connivance of the Turkish government. There was a press TV reporter who was killed showing that the Turkish government just basically turned a blind eye and opened the borders to let these convoys bring oil in and supplies out. And it turns out that it's the brother-in-law of the Turkish president, Erdogan, who was the guy who was receiving all this oil through Turkey and taking a rake off. And a lot of this oil ended up transshipped through Israel, which is, a partner in this Western aggression against Syria.
Right. Now, Ken, we're interviewing you today, and I heard you on, I think it's a show called Sunday Wire, a very, very nice interview. It's sort of a rhetorical question because I think I know the answer. But have you been contacted by anybody in the so-called mainstream media? Because you've been to Syria. Very few Canadians have been there recently. You have very insightful observations. So has there been any attempt to contact you by the so-called mainstream press?
No, and it's worse than that. I actually went to, I sent messages and left phone calls at the Hamilton Spectator because I thought that they might appreciate, they have published my stuff in the past, and I thought they might appreciate, you know, an exclusive story right from a Hamiltonian in Syria. I never even got a response, I'm sorry to say. Never even got a response from the Spectator to a free offer, you know, to be their correspondent in Syria to cover the elections or any of the other things we did, meeting ministers and meeting the governor of Homs. They weren't interested.
Right, and you know that what we're seeing seems to be a total blackout in the corporate media on anything that deviates from the official line, which is Assad must go, and you know we need regime change and all the other things that follow. From that, I think it highlights the need for independent alternative media such as we have at CFMU and on Unusual Sources. It's really disgraceful that the corporate media can. It's almost like lying by omission. You know that you suppress a big part of the story, and then you spread a different line, but that doesn't really stand up to scrutiny.
Well, it didn't used to be like this. I mean, occasionally in the past, CBC, for example, used to put on interview people on important questions of war and peace from the anti-war movement. And they used to interview people like Dr. Kaboursi here from McMaster University. He says he hasn't been approached in years for an interview. And, you know, acting on behalf of the Hamilton Coalition, Stop the War, I've sent out media releases to the Toronto Star, to the CBC, CTV, Spectator, Globe and Mail, and, you know, I follow them up with phone calls, and they just ignore it completely. So, yes, the alternative media like Unusual Sources is to be commended for picking up where the mainstream media has unfortunately and shamefully fallen off. And it was the same, not just for us in Canada, but all the other members of the Solidarity mission that we had to Syria reported the same thing. They have to struggle to get the word out through alternative media. For example, Jeff Klein was one of the contributors, was one of the members of the delegation, and he writes for Counterpunch. And he wrote an article about Palmyra as well, because everybody in the world wants to know about Palmyra. But, you know, it's not the mainstream media, it's Counterpunch. And the Norwegians, have to fight to get a letter to the editor into their local newspapers. So they had a friend who has, a blog that's read by 50,000 Norwegians, which is, one-fifth of the population of Oslo. And so that's where they get their stuff, you know, published. But the mainstream media is, unfortunately, totally in the pocket of the government, and they are not going to give us one word edgewise.
Right. And so for our listeners, people that do listen to alternative media and do get news from yourself and other people like Atif Kaboursi and so on, have you got any suggestions for what people can do?
About
the situation in Syria. I think it's sort of confusing, but we are part of NATO and we are part of Friends of Syria group.
Well, those things are really obvious. Where Canada, will never be able to have an independent foreign policy until we get out of NATO, and we actually should belong to the non-aligned movement. That's what we should really belong to, the group that represents about two-thirds of the countries of the world. If we were in that non-aligned movement, we would be able to take an independent stand on the big war and peace issues of the world. But as long as we're part of NATO, we always get sucked into every war that the United States wants to wage. As for the Friends of Syria group, that was, unfortunately, I'm really ashamed to say, organized with the special help of the Harper government. They organized the pre-conference to the founding conference of the so-called Friends of Syria group in Tunis in February 2012. And what that group did was that was the group that had a division of labor and decided to overthrow the government of legally the government of Syria and depose the president Bashar al-Assad by dividing up the tasks of training, arming, and funding the mercenaries. What can we do about this? I could start by saying, you know, write your MP and stuff like that. That's normal kind of stuff. But the fact is that most of us, most of your listeners, probably belong to some kind of organization, a trade union, a church, or some organization, some public organization that, you know, that at times takes positions on international affairs or on national affairs. And I think what we have to do is to bring up in our organizations the fact that Canada should drop its economic sanctions against Syria, which the Harper government helped to organize. Canada should normalize relations with Syria, reestablish embassies. And this has happened. Several countries have recently done that. I think Tunisia was one of them. I think Algeria was another. They reestablished their ties with Syria. Because when you break your diplomatic relations and you close your embassy, you're saying the next thing is war. You're closing the doors to diplomacy. You're making it almost impossible for the people from your citizens who come from there to have any access back home. Your travelers who are there are going to have no representation. It's a very bad situation. The French government recently, and I'm hoping that the Canadian MPs will follow suit, the French government recently sent a fact-finding mission to Syria. They met with President Bashar al-Assad, and the fact-finding mission consisted of, I think, 25 members of parliament and a whole bunch of journalists and intellectuals. And that's because I think the French government is seeing that the tactic of toppling the Syrian government failed, so they have to find something else to do. They have to start normalizing relations. I would like to see people in Canada, through their trade unions, churches, you know, families, professional organizations, putting pressure on the Canadian government, the Trudeau government, to send a fact-finding mission of MPs and journalists to Syria. That's the very first step we could do. I've spoken to one MP in the Hamilton area, and there's interest. Probably if other people, you know, spoke to their MPs and said to them, why don't you get a fact-finding mission going? Why don't you go yourself and find out what's really going on in Syria? Don't believe what's in the newspapers. I think that might be a way to, the thin edge of the wedge to break down the state of war we're in right now.
Right, and you know, contrast our breaking diplomatic relations with Syria and sanctions to the $15 billion arms deal with the most, truly the most oppressive regime probably on the planet in Saudi Arabia. And we have full relations and we're courting them for more business. And, you know, it's quite a hypocritical, I think, the way we treat different countries in the Middle East. If a country, it appeared to me that Syria's main problem was that they were taking an independent position from the West. Just to say that the leader must go and the country must be turned over, it strikes me as neocolonialism.
You're absolutely right. It is neocolonialism, and it is a hypocritical. There's a huge double standard. The Saudi Arabian monarchy has never held an election. They recently beheaded 47 people, I think it was in one day, and including a Shia cleric by the name of Nimr al-Nimr, whose only crime was that he called for peaceful reform to the Saudi Arabian state. And The Canadian government had nothing, no complaints to make about that. They didn't call for the regime change.
Right. Okay, well, on that note, I think our time is up, so I'll just quickly repeat our announcements. We've got two events coming up. On May 10th, we have the dinner with Peter Larson, The Future of the Children of Gaza. His lecture starts at 7:30, but you can get there early at 5:30 and have dinner for $25, four-course dinner. And then the picket of the Jewish National Fund dinner at the Laguna Station, May 16th, 5:30 p.m. at 360 James Street North. So for Brendan Stone, myself, that's it for this week from Unusual Sources. Take care.